talk to you about a psychological theorist then, whose name is Erik Erikson. He's a psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist, and he's also right now a teacher at Harvard University, as well as being a practicing psychoanalyst. And he's developed a theory in a book that he's written called Childhood and Society, where he says that practically this, that man does have a goal in life, and this goal is one that is not determined by him, but determined by the nature of man. That it's up to man not only to discover what this goal is, and sometimes it isn't even necessary to do that, but to live in order to fulfill this goal if he's going to be happy. That happiness is a byproduct of this goal, and happiness itself is not necessarily the goal, so it happens when a person does this. That the goal of all man is what he calls a stage of ego integrity, a sense, and I'm going to have to, in order to make this goal clear, I think, go through the entire 8 stages of this theory and give you some background about why it happened. But he says that in order for a man to be truly human or to achieve his full humanity, in other words, to achieve this goal which is set for him, he must reach a stage, and this happens in what he calls mature adulthood. He doesn't give any real age for this, but sort of suggests that it happens at the earliest, in a man's early 30s, at least typically. And he also says that very few people ever do this. Very few people ever achieve this goal because of what we talked about before, man's basically selfish nature. But the goal of man is to identify with all mankind as brothers, to sort of put a man's identity in the identity of all mankind. And in order to do this, he also achieves something that very much like a religious point of view. He says that there is something above and beyond my own personal identity at stake, my own personal welfare. This is something that's directed under what's really a spiritual force. It doesn't have to be a Christian God or any necessary organized religion. But a man has to sort of, at this stage in life, when he identifies with all mankind as a brother of his, sort of submits his identity to the welfare of this spiritual, to the control of this spiritual kind of order in the world. That there is a purpose in life, that there is a meaning in life, that things do make sense, that goals that even appear to be ridiculous somehow fit into this order of things. And that when a man achieves this sense of what he calls equal integrity, then he achieves his goal in life, identification with all mankind. When this happens, he becomes not only mentally healthy, but happy. This is what true happiness involves, says Erik Erikson. And in order to make an argument for his case, this is sort of what I believe too, that man does have a goal. I wouldn't necessarily say it is exactly the same, but I think the same things happen. That for a human being to be truly human, he will have what we call a love for all other human beings, whether he comes in contact with them or not, in physical contact, and that when this happens, it's only then that he'll be truly what I call happy. And I know happiness has different definitions, but I don't even think I'll be able to finish this today, and I'd have to continue it tomorrow. But let me say I believe this and then start going backwards and showing where the evidence comes for this point of view and why Erik Erikson says this. His training as a psychoanalyst necessarily meant that he had to attend the psychoanalytic institutes, one of the psychoanalytic institutes. That's the only way a person can become a psychoanalyst, to study Freudian theory. And this, in turn, in order to find out why Erik Erikson says what he does, it becomes necessary to sort of see what he's reacting to, which is Freudian theory. Freudian theoretically basically states, and I don't know just how detailed I should get about this, but basically states that man at birth is interested only in his own sensual pleasure. Freud says that at birth an infant's mouth is his most important area, and all of his activities are centered for gratification of the oral zone. A baby wants to suck when he's first born, and that's all he really cares about. If he's given enough sucking stimulation, he's happy. After a little while, when his teeth start to erupt, and this is kind of like an itch that has to be scratched, he has to stimulate his mouth all the more in order to ease the tension that's aroused by teeth coming through the gums of the baby. That psychologically, at about age, depending on the cultural situation, this is more culturally determined than biologically, potty training is started. The situation is sort of like this. In this culture, it's about age 15 months, though we know now from studies that the best time to potty train a baby is either between age 6 months and 9 months, or otherwise after age 24 months, for some very good reasons. At age 6 months, a baby's learned how to sit up typically by himself. He doesn't really have to be held, and he can sit. And he's so proud of this feat. I shouldn't really say feet if he's sitting. But he's so proud of this ability to sit, that he'll sit for a long period of time and maybe play with rattles and maybe with nothing, but he can sit for hours sometimes just engrossed in this delightful new task that he's learned. And at this time, all a mother has to do is put the baby on the potty chair before he performs this function of elimination, and he'll sometimes sit for hours and hours until finally he does, and then mother notices and praises him, and pretty soon by age 1 year, the baby will pretty much be aware of what's happened. That mother praises him for going potty, and he sort of gets in the habit of being potty trained. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, after 24 months, the baby wants so much to identify with mommy and daddy that he either is told or he notices that mommy and daddy don't wet their pants, and what they do is they go potty. And so he pretty soon starts to imitate mother and father, and he wants to go potty. Instead of wearing diapers, he wants to wear big boy pants. And so he'll go potty. But according to Freudian theory, especially in a society like ours, which is somewhat lenient as far as many other societies and a lot more strict as far as others, we start potty training at around age 15 months as the main emphasis in potty training in our culture. We know this through just asking mothers when they really become serious about potty training their babies throughout this nation. It differs somewhat in socioeconomic classes. But according to Freud, when this happens, that a baby really is pushed towards potty training at a time when he's least likely to want to. See, he's been conditioned by now. By age 15 months, who is it, Pepsi-Cola that causes this, the pause that refreshes? The kid's eyes kind of glass over, and he gets this silly kind of a smile, and he wets his pants, and it's a very comfortable, natural kind of a phenomenon. And it has its own reward. It's warm at first, and it's you know, this full bladder or full bowel, it does cause some kind of pleasure in allowing this tension to be released. And now mother and father will let him do this. He starts to wet his pants, and they get all excited, and they push him on the potty, and they spank him when he does this very natural thing, and it's very frustrating. His condition, he has to be reconditioned, relearn what he's already made a habit out of. And this is frustrating for him. Not only that, but at this age, he doesn't want to sit still very long either. Any of you that have had any experience with a 15-month-old child realize that he's a bundle of energy more than anything else. And he doesn't like this idea of sitting still on the potty chair to be trained. Well, because of this, because it's a socially very important skill to learn, potty training, and because it's emphasized so much, because it's emphasized so much by the parents and is disliked so intensely by a child at this age, it becomes psychologically very important to him. And this area of the body now, rather than his mouth, assumes the most important, the area of sensitivity. Now, Freud's theory says that a human being is motivated mostly for sensual, or what he calls erotic pleasure. He calls these zones of the body autoerotic zones at first, and later on erotic zones as a person grows up. But all a person really mostly is concerned about is first stimulation of the mouth, and then later this kind of stimulation involved in potty training, which he calls the anal stage of a person. And after person, and there are two stages to this too. The first one, children are marvelous this way. They figure things out so well and without any really trying. A kid at first in this anal stage, Freud calls it an anal retentive stage. All this means is that the kid denies that he has to go potty when this becomes a conflict. And you'll see little Johnny dancing around and jumping up and down, and the mother says, "Johnny, do you have to go potty?" And he says, "No." He just refuses to go through this trauma of learning to go potty. And this anal retentive stage, the person starts incorporating in his bladder and in his bowel this material, And in order to sort of, it's like an ostrich with its head in the sand, and it's called a defense mechanism of denial. Pretty soon, though, the kid learns this doesn't work. You can only do this for so long. And things happen. When we talk about Erik Erikson, we'll notice that there are some very humorous accounts that he relates in his book of therapy with children at about this age who have become so severely constipated, or that's especially, I think, one of the more humorous of his incidents, where he relates, well, we'll get into that maybe later. I want to stick on Freud at first to let you know how Erikson reacts to this. Next, the child does an opposite technique. After he learns that denial doesn't work, that he eventually has to go. You know, you've heard this statement, when you gotta go, you gotta go, and it's true. Yeah. Then next, the child starts what Freud calls the anal expulsive stage. That the kid's gotta go all the time. And some people, I remember, I teach a course on Freud, and I remember one kid in the exam, when they were talking about these stages, I was writing about the anal explosive instead of the anal expulsive stage. You see the symbolism here. Right? But what happens here is a child again has learned how he can manipulate his parents now. It's sort of a defense mechanism. Little kids at this age, you probably notice too, many of you like a lot of attention. They always like somebody paying attention to them. Well, this is a time, a lot of times, when mother will have a bridge club in, let's say, and he can't get her attention. Mommy, you know, do this and that. And he hits on this technique, mommy, I gotta go potty. And immediately mom drops her cards and says, girls, I'll be right back. I gotta take Johnny potty. Or maybe he'll do this in other ways. He's sitting eating, and mother says, now you eat that spinach or you don't get any ice cream, this kind of thing. And he hates spinach. And he says, but I have to go potty. And so mom says, well, all right. And he takes some potty, and he waits long enough, and he comes back, and his spinach is cold. And mother sort of says, well, it's cold spinach. Go ahead and have your ice cream. Or maybe it's bedtime. And the kid says, I need a drink of water, you know, because this is the first ploy the kids commonly use. I die of thirst if I don't have a drink of water that night. And so mother goes and gives him a drink of water and says, now that's it, now you go to sleep. And some kids are bright enough, they say, but I had a drink of water, now I have to go potty. And so you see a lot of kids sort of, I don't know what it is, if they realize the biology of the system or what, but somehow after a drink of water, they got to go potty. And so they do, and mother takes them up, and they can be up sometimes 3 or 4 times going potty. And mother doesn't want to keep them in bed, because you know darn well the kid says, if you don't let me go potty, I'm going to wet the bed. Even though we know darn well a kid doesn't have to go potty, we know too that if he says he's going to wet the bed, he will. He'll find some way. And so the kid manipulates the parents this way in the anal expulsive stage. And it becomes a very important area of this kid's life that he learns how to go potty, at least according to Freud. Very important psychological stage. And the third stage, and the kid probably is potty trained by age 2, 2.5 or so, and sometime between this age and around age 3 or 3.5, the kid changes biologically, so that now the most sensitive area of his body is no longer his lips. And physicians realize this. I'd have to ask Dr. Larson for confirmation. I'm sure he'd say that when a baby is born, I know of psychological studies where they tickle or sometimes poke with pins every part of the baby's body, and they notice the most severe reaction is around the mouth. Now this is no longer true at age 3.5 or so. The genital area becomes the most pleasurable, the most sensitive area of a kid's body. And psychologically, Freud says this is very important, especially in a prudish or a repressive society about sex. And Freud condemned repression extremely. That's another topic that, you know, whether it's right or wrong to be open about sexual expression. There are a lot of arguments on both sides. But Freud condemned this repression. He said it causes neurosis. And let me give you examples of this. One of the things that's very common for a kid at this age, because this area of his body is most sensitive, is to manipulate this part of his body to give himself pleasure. We talked about this yesterday as the Aladdin and his magic lamp kind of a complex, but it's a very important one. I remember one of our neighbors one time, a very delightful neighbor, and he had very delightful kids, very, very energetic kids. But this neighbor came over, and I didn't know him too well at the time. We just moved into our house, been there for a few months. And he came over and he said, he called me Mr. Bongard at that time. He was very formal about it, and he had this very nervous look about him, very embarrassed. He said, I have something I want to talk to you about. So I invited him in, sat him down. We chatted for a while, and then he came to the subject, and he said, "I know you teach psychology," he says, up at St. Olaf, is that right? Yeah, he says, and you teach about ways to rear children and things like that, and about what goes wrong, you know, and what happens in abnormal children. I said, yeah, I've taught courses like that. And he stuttered around and he stammered. I said, "I got this awful problem." He says, "I don't know what I've done wrong, but I got this awful problem." And he finally stammered out and he said, "You know, my 4-year-old daughter," and I knew who she was. Well, and he said it and stammered, he said, "She's a pervert. She's a sexual pervert. My 4-year-old daughter." And I was kind of surprised at this. And I asked him to explain what the matter was. And he said, well, he had gone out to his garage. He's an insurance salesman, and he's home quite often in the afternoon. And he'd gone out to his garage one afternoon, ready to leave on a call or something, and he heard all these noises behind the garage instead of inside it. And he went around and looked, and there was his 4-year-old daughter with about 8 or 9 6-year-old boys standing around, and she was stripped nude. All these guys were clapping and applauding. And he just said, "What have I done wrong? You know, what can we do for her? How have we failed?" And he was extremely upset. And I told him that according to my point of view, and at least according to that of Freud, that these kind of experiences are very, very common in little kids at this age, that they have an intense curiosity about parts of their body, especially these sexual parts, because they are so pleasant to stimulate, especially at this age and for somewhat older age too, that some of their main preoccupations at this time have to do with things that are related to sex. It might be, they might be going, "Oh, I know the theory, but sometimes theory is so hard to put into practice. The theory says that when children do these kind of things, you know, it's just part of growing up and don't take it too seriously." But the most upset I have ever gotten with our older daughter, who is now 4, 4 and a half, was this last spring, some months before we came here. And I looked out of the window, and here all over the sidewalk there was melting snow, and we made her put on her overshoes so that she wouldn't get all wet in the puddles. And she had her pants off, and she was squatting down in one of these puddles, making it bigger so there'd be more water to splash in. And I remember, you know, here's the theory. This is the kind of thing kids will do. They don't think anything at all of it. But the first thought that went through my mind is, my gosh, what are the neighbors going to think about it? And I ran out and gave her a little spanking and put her pants on and brought her in the house and told her never to do that, which is not really the right thing to do. Psychologists say, you know, this is the kind of behavior goal. But it is a natural kind of a thing. They're very free and open and very interested in this kind of behavior. I heard a story in it, and it strikes me as being very true. It wasn't at Holden Village, but it well could have been the kind of things when you go on hikes. These two families, and one family had girls and the other family had boys, were in a place where there were no potty facilities. And so they went potty, and as luck might have it, they were within seeing distance of each other, and the girls were having all kinds of trouble because they had to squat down and had to be careful not to get their pants wet. And they looked over and they noticed that the boys weren't having any trouble. And they asked their mother why they couldn't bring one of those handy little things along for picnic. They're very, very curious and very interested and very open about their expression about matters sexual, which causes parents an awful lot of problems. And because it does, one of the things that happens a lot of times in kids is that they repress things of this nature. Things that repression means they kind of put them out of their mind, but it causes them trouble. Freud said, and we talked about this, I think it was yesterday, it may have been in the discussion group or someplace, we talked about the Little Red Riding Hood, the Oedipal complex that occurs here, where there's a very, according to Freud, a sexual kind of a feeling about the parent of the opposite sex that is triggered off really by, maybe naturally, but definitely aided by a parent's view about sex at this time. Well, I'm not going to get into a lot of these things. Kids talk a lot about birth. They want to know where babies come from. It's one thing that psychologists have noticed here, and there are very few things that they tell parents to do in practice. But psychologists are quite certain now that it's the wrong thing for a parent to do to tell kids that babies are brought by storks. And one of the reasons why, I think, is that one psychologist he records this conversation he had with a little boy who was very upset. He said, I wish that you'd help me and tell Mom. He said, Mom thinks babies come from storks. He said, and I know they don't, but she thinks they do. And I wish you'd help her and tell her where that. He didn't know where they came from, but he knew it wasn't storks, and he wanted the psychologist to tell his mommy so mommy could tell him, and we both get it straight. And little kids don't swallow these kind of stories, and a lot of times it causes trouble. But we could go a lot in here about this area of what Freud calls the phallic stage, but I think we have enough background in these areas. Freud then says what happens is that a child loses all of his energy or changes his energy from sex at age about 6 until about age, well, puberty, about 12.6 for girls or 14.8 for boys, to be sort of specific. And Freud says what happens here is that this is a latency period, he calls. When nothing happens psychosexually, he says all of man's energy is a sexual energy. He calls this a life instinct, but he says it's libidinal energy, it's a sexual energy. This is the entire motivation of man, is to fulfill his sexual impulses, either his autoerotic tendencies to give his own body pleasure, and to preserve his own life, or otherwise to preserve the species. But we also talked, I think, in here before about how sometimes, in fact, in every human being, this libidinal or sexual or life energy is diverted into the opposite, death instinct or thanatos, or there are other terms used for this, because of frustration. But that's kind of a different story, and it took us, I guess, just about knowing to develop that theme one other day. What happens in this latency period, according to Freud, is that two defense mechanisms emerge, and that these are noticeable among all children in this culture. And it's only because of sex. What they do is they either sublimate, he says, sexual energy, and he says that all artistic or all productive or all creative energy is just sexual energy that's doing something symbolic of sex. Freud is the first person that I know of to say that man is basically a symbolic animal, that almost everything he does that's important, he does symbolically rather than a kind of a literal representation of what he wants to do. So that when man has sexual urges that are being repressed by the society, remember mother and father say sex is bad at this age, and children shouldn't be sexual. The kids kind of pick this up. And instead of spending their energy on sex, which is for what? Sex is for procreation. They spend it instead on creation, or let's say sex is for reproduction. Kids spend it instead on production. They do it in ways that Freud says are symbolic of sex. They learn how to read and write. They learn how to do the skills that make them a male instead of a female, like play football instead of learn how to play hopscotch or jump rope. You see, differentiating the role of the sexes here. Now, this is one very good defense mechanism, but it's really sexual, says Freud. Freud said all of man's activity basically has to be sexual because he's so selfish and sex gives him the most pleasure. It's sensual and erotic. Or otherwise, he uses a defense mechanism that he talks about that he says is reaction formation. Whereas normally people are attracted to each other in a sexual way, kids at this age become, you know, you talk to a little boy about little girls, for instance. You know, here's a 7-year-old boy. You have a girlfriend? Yeah. You know, girls are, you wouldn't be caught dead. That's about the only way you would be caught with a girl is dead. Just incomprehensible that there'd be anything at all of this kind of relationship or anything sexual. Reaction formation is still a common kind of thing. A lot of times we do this in things that we know are pleasure. Even sticking in this area of sex, I know of what I think is a beautiful illustration of reaction formation. What reaction formation does, it takes something that inherently you desire, but the culture tells you is undesirable. And so you never do it, but you condemn it, even though you really want to do it. Maybe I'll just tell you two examples here. One of them is a society in Boston that had a name, some kind of, it had the name Royalty, I think, in it, I don't remember for sure. But a legitimate society in Boston that would spend every other night at a striptease show in a section of Boston, apparently, where there are lots of these. And these were people who were high up in society, and they, you know, striptease shows were things they shouldn't go to. The reason they went, they claimed, was to condemn this. That every night after they finished this activity, and while they were at the activity, they took very close notes about what went on a little notepad that they brought along. And after the activity was over, they together as a group compiled a letter to the editor of one of Boston's papers, condemning this vile, obscene, and noting in the letter some of the things these girls did, you know, the activities they went through in the striptease, to condemn it. This was a terrible thing. Only a lot of people didn't believe that. They thought, there's something about about defense mechanisms like this, especially reaction formation, that, see, what, how do we know, for instance, that these people, this was a defense mechanism and it was something they really liked, instead of, say, we have a civic-minded citizen who wants to clean up striptease places, you know, for the good of the morality of the country or something. Well, these people that I talked about first had such a pleasure, an obvious pleasure and delight in their note-taking, you know, very eagerly doing this, and it also became an obsession with them. They wouldn't talk about anything else except how they had to clean up striptease shows. Whenever anybody becomes completely obsessed with an evil, and also you notice there's an ambivalence of affect, is the way the psychologists call it. They say that they hate this kind of behavior, but they show a real positive light for it, a real attraction for it. This is a defense mechanism of reaction formation. I was invited to a woman's house once who would follow all evening long. All she'd talk about is how the filthy mouthed people around her. Everybody she knew, it seemed like, said a swear word every so often, and her neighbors were the worst ones to blame. She told us, and she repeated quite often, about some of the phrases that her neighbor lady swore at her kids and what a filthy lady that was and how disgusting it was. And after this had gone on for hours and hours, finally her little daughter, age 5 or 6 it must have been, verified this, the fact of this. She said, you know, this afternoon, all afternoon, Mommy and I stayed in the bathroom with the window open and listened out the window to the neighbor lady as she swore at her kids. And this is what they'd done all afternoon. Now there's a real indication here that if you're going to really condemn something, you don't spend all afternoon listening to it. You know, this is, you avoid it. And if this was a, well, I'm starting to get too technical about some of these things. Let me just go on. During the latency period, says Freud, sex is still important, but it's disguised. It's either reacted against where little boys say girls are icky, or otherwise it's used in ways that allow for creation instead of procreation or generativity, you see, which also has as its root, you know, generation really refers to this reproductive process, or production instead of reproduction. Very symbolic, says Freud, is sexual activity. And then comes adolescence or puberty, when a person again is, the genital area of his body is extremely pleasurable, and says Freud, now this is the tradition Eric Erickson was reared in, or studied under, the goal of man, his entire goal, is to allow himself to fulfill his bodily pleasure in sex in such a way so that it's no longer what he called narcissistic, or other psychologists call egocentric, or just purely selfish, but in a way that is a significant relationship with another human being. So Freud says the goal of man is to progress from autoerotic sexual activity, or what we could call homosexual activity, is self kind of stimulation, into a heterosexual one, so that there's a relationship of love and trust, but this relationship is not complete without physically experiencing a sexual relationship of intense enjoyment. This is the goal of man, says Freud, to get out of himself, to relate to another person at a significant level, which is a sexual level, so that both people then enjoy their own company in a very physical way, and in a way that also helps procreate the species, and in a way that gives enjoyment to both of them, and also produces or encourages love and trust between these two. This is the entire goal of human beings, according to Freud. Now, Eric Erickson studied under Freud, not under Freud, but at the Psychoanalytic Institute. And he started noticing several things wrong with Freudian theory, and he did this through much of his clinical practice, and then formulated a theory that sort of opposes Freud. Freud said, for instance, that the baby's main goal in life is mouth stimulation, sucking. And Eric Erickson pointed to experiments done that many of you probably read about by Harry Harlow, a psychologist at the University of Wisconsin, with monkeys. What Harry Harlow did is he took different groups of monkeys, the same kind, these are rhesus monkeys, and he reared some of them on a wire mother where they were fed. Not a real monkey mother, but he took terry cloth mothers and wire mothers. And some of the monkeys were reared fed only by wire mothers, but given access to both mothers. Others were fed only by terry cloth mothers, but were given access to both mothers. And that's not what we need to know about this experiment. It makes a point. Harlow found out a very funny thing, as far as Freud's theory is concerned. Those monkeys that were fed on wire mothers, this is where all their mouth stimulation came from, all their sucking needs came from, still preferred to go to the terry cloth mothers all the time. they spent about 85 to 90% of their time, if they were with one or another mother, they spent it on the terry cloth mother. And they loved to cuddle it and hold it and feel soft with it. And Harlow said, it's very funny, if Freud's theory is right, Freud would predict that the more satisfaction you get, the more attached you get to something, that there seems to be something more than just mouth stimulation at work here. The babies that were fed on the terry cloth mothers also preferred the terry cloth mothers. And Harlow said this, and something that's been borne out by later research, that there's something more important to monkeys, and later on we find this is true of human beings too, something more important than mouth stimulation, and this is what we call tactile stimulation, that somehow affectionate relationships, and not only affectionate relationships, but one of security too. These monkeys, for instance, were presented with a fear stimulus, a little toy bear that you wind up and it drums a little drum and it walks along on its feet. You wind it up at the end of this kind of a cord and the monkey bear at the end. And this little toy bear is a terrifying experience for these monkeys to see. He's drumming this little drum and walking up to them. And it's not a very large one. It's about so big. Just a little wind-up kid's toy. But the monkeys were terrified of it. And as soon as the monkeys were given an opportunity to cling to the terry cloth mother, they lost their fear of this bear and started to explore it. And they were secure. If they were not permitted access to the terry cloth monkey, they see, this is in the absence of a real mother. These monkeys were all removed from their real mothers. They never lost their insecurity, and they were always afraid and huddled in a corner, given access only to the wire mother. And what Harlow said about this is, there seems to be something about the nature of tactile stimulation, of cuddling, or clinging, or close contact, especially of a soft nature, that provides what we call both security and love, affectionate relationship. And Erik Erikson took this study as one of the basic parts of his theory and showed many, many others on human subjects and on animal subjects that showed that for an infant from age birth until 1 year old, for monkeys it's a less time, but for human infants, from birth to 1 year old, the only way that love can significantly be communicated or that an affectional attachment can be made between a human infant and its caretaker, which we call a mother, whether it happens to be male or female. If it's a caretaker, we now call it a mother. The only way that security can be had, which Erik Erikson later on calls trust, that the goal of an infant in his environment is to establish trust and an affectionate relationship. The only way this can be done is by physical contact. A mother has to touch her baby. She has to pick it up. She has to cuddle it and hold it and be near it. And if a mother does not do this, again using the word mother in its sort of generic sense of caretaker, if a baby is not picked up and cuddled and has someone near it, it will develop many, many illnesses of either a psychological or a physical nature. And again, we talked about some of these before. One of them is called anaclitic depression. And I'll just sort of mention this again because it's the most important one. We now call it infantile schizophrenia. And if Renee Spitz did some experiments in Mexico that showed that when the nurses didn't have time to cuddle the babies but only gave them their food and their clothing, diaper changes, that many of these babies not only became sick and died, I mean, many of them did become about 60%. It was 60% morbidity rate at any given moment. 60% of these babies were sick enough to require medical attention. And it was something like 20% mortality rate that as the year went by, 20% of the babies died. But also 15% of these babies, where all their physical needs were met, they were given food and germ-free environment as much as could be, developed infantile schizophrenia. They got a glassy-eyed stare, a rocking motion in their body. They wouldn't pay attention to human beings and they'd stop eating. They wouldn't respond to the stimulus. Well, there's lots and lots more experiments like this, and we've already talked about some of them, that made Erik Erikson conclude this, that it isn't so important what kind of stimulation a baby gets. Even punishment is better than nothing. Physical contact of any kind is better than no contact at all, and it need not be of a sucking kind or of a lip stimulation at all. It can be any kind of a tactile stimulation. This will provide the baby, at least I suppose in some cases, if it's only of a punishment kind, you know, you beat the kid, it wouldn't be as effective. But tactile stimulation otherwise will provide the baby with a sense of security or basic trust in life. And this is done, you see Harlow's experiment with monkeys show that this is done much better by tactile stimulation even than sucking contact. You suck from the wire mother and not from the terry cloth mother, you still have the terry cloth mother. And this sort of answered a question that psychologists for a long time had debated, whether a mother should always breastfeed her baby or bottle feed her baby or you know, which was necessary. for a long time, you know, one group said one said the other, and Eric Erickson was the one who by, he actually did other experiments than the ones I've mentioned, showed that that it isn't important either one, both work. All that is important is that the mother gives the baby tactile stimulation, and the good results of breastfeeding were because the mother picked the baby up. That if the mother picks the baby up and bottle feeds it, the same thing happens. Or if somebody else bottle feeds it, the mother comes home at night and cuddles her baby and is with it. This has to happen. If this doesn't happen, Eric Erickson said, if a baby doesn't have sort of a sense of basic trust in life, he doesn't receive tactile stimulation, then he develops a sense of life that's sort of bordering on despair. A baby that receives basic trust develops a hope for the future, a sense of trust in life, and a sense of kind of optimism about life. Regardless of what goes wrong, somebody's going to be here to love me or help me out of this. And I guess I won't go into too many of the... let me just go on to the next stage and maybe we can come back and I'll answer questions or something to make this in more detail. The second stage, says Eric Erickson, and these stages coincide with Freud's ages. Freud says this is an age of potty training. Erickson says that's really sort of ridiculous. The second stage, see now, let me make this point. What I'm doing now is detailing Eric Erickson's stages that he said are the goals of personality development at different ages. If a person has these goals reached, he will, in the end, be a happy human being. He will be one that identifies with all of mankind. If he misses any one of these goals, and they must be reached in this progression, you can't go ahead and identify and love all human mankind and then later on come back and have this sense of basic trust in the world. You've got to do it the opposite way. In exactly the order he details it, a person must go through these stages. First, he develops an affectionate relationship with another human being, a sense of trust in the world. This gives him his hope and drive and optimism. The next stage, after he receives the first stage, he receives a sense of what Erickson calls autonomy, but we can call it selfhood. The baby starts to realize, now at first you see, and there are a lot of things about Freud's theory I didn't go into, he talks about the id, the ego, and the superego, and says that the baby's born only with it, and what this is a very selfish principle and also a very subjective one. He's at the center of his whole world, and he doesn't see really anybody else in his world, and he's a part of the whole world in a very different way than what he is in adulthood. It's sort of like a drop of water in a bucket of water. The baby, you know, he doesn't really tell himself as different from mother, and the world is never objective for him, but only subjective. The way he sees it is the only way it is. Well, Eric Erickson says that in the second stage of life, a person sort of loses this sense in many ways. He's still egocentric in many ways, but he loses it in other ways. What happens is this, is that potty training is involved here. As a kid begins potty training and realizes that he is in control of certain of his body movements, that he can either withhold these things or let them go, he develops a certain sense of, I am not just a part of my mother, I am a me. And one of his favorite words, those of you who are parents or have seen kids at about this age, around age 2, let's say, this is approximately the middle of this stage, his favorite word is what? What? Anybody around here parenting? What's the kid's most favorite word at age 2?
Daddy.
Well,
no.
That's
no.
What?
No.
Well, there are a lot of these things that are typical of these kids. The psychologists say when they actually record which words are spoken most often, it's true that he always talks about mine and me. But his favorite word is no.
Yeah.
No. You tell him to do something, no. Or you try to help him with something. I remember we live in Minnesota, and we try to help our girls on at age 2, I'm remembering, not with their snowsuits. Very difficult process to put a snowsuit on a kid. But at age 2, no, I'll do it by myself. Don't help me. No. Whatever you do to help, it's always no. By myself becomes a very favorite phrase, too. They want to assert their sense of autonomy or selfhood. I'm an individual person, they're sort of saying, and I'm not just an extension of you, and I don't have to do everything you tell me. There are certain things I want to rely on myself for. A sense of individuality is established already at this age, around age 2. And it's too tragic, really, that so many parents don't realize this is necessary. So many kids that have so much potential are beaten into submission all the time. And that when they want to do something by themselves, mother says, it's so much faster if I put it on you. And the mother always does these things for the kid and makes the kid do what she says in everything. And it's kind of tragic because then the kid never is able to progress to the last stage, you know, that of identity with all mankind, because he has to have his own sense of selfhood first. Well, that's the second stage, says Erickson. A kid has to have some feeling of autonomy. And when he does this, he develops a certain sense of willpower that parents often don't like, but that later on enable him, in fact, in the next stage, enable him to do something else, to direct this willpower or this self-hood into a constructive direction. Erickson calls this stage that of initiative. And this is very true. Kids have a lot of initiative at this stage. I can remember, let me just give you some examples of our own kids. And this age of initiative corresponds to Freud's phallic stage from about 3.5 to 5.5 or 6. Well, our daughter's now 4.5, and I remember just a couple months ago, she was teaching our younger daughter. This was when Mary was being involved in the area of potty training. And Lori was all of her own initiative. We didn't know about this at all. But Lori was teaching Mary how to wipe when you go potty. They didn't have to go potty. They just had gone up to the bathroom. And Lori was explaining this procedure of how one wipes oneself at this activity. And when we got up there, and this must have been hours later, the way our bathroom is arranged is that in this particular day, that's my wife, had bought a large, they come in, I guess, 8 packs of toilet paper. And when we got up into the bathroom, you probably already imagined the scene that we saw here. She was still Mary with her pants down, and about 7 rolls of toilet paper in pieces about this long were scattered all over, and the toilet was overflowing with them, and all over the bathroom here are these little pieces of toilet paper. Because Lori, on her own initiative, you see, had directed this certain amount of energy into a useful task. And she had, it's a real funny thing that Mary, I don't know if Mary's an idiot or what, but she still doesn't really know after all this training. Or another incident, Lori, all of her own initiative again, and this was over a year ago now, it was last summer because it was quite hot out, had taken the initiative to cut their hair, both her own and Mary's. And they both, I remember we had taken their pictures a little earlier, and I remember Gail remarking how proud she was of this long hair that they both were developing and had finally grown. And Lori had first snipped off her own, and she'd taken lumps right off here and all around the side, and then she'd cut Mary's hair. But on Mary's hair, she hadn't gone all the way around. She started apparently in the front and cut back about halfway, and Mary had long hair on this side and short hair on this side. And right, it's taken about a year now for the kids to have their hair grow out again, so it looks nice. So we all tried to finish it up. But here was Lori so proud. The way we found out about this, when Mary's hair was half done, Lori came downstairs with a handful of hair, and she said, "Look, Mommy, what I've done. I've cut our hair." And she had these, you know, big lumps of one hand golden hair and the other hand brownish kind of hair. And we went upstairs and saw the results of this initiative. But the kids that have this display this kind of initiative in lots of ways like this. Some of them aren't so good. I mean, kids might want to find out what happens if you put bobby pins into electric wall sockets or a lot of things that can be very dangerous and have to be forbidden. But what Erickson says is this is a very necessary stage, that a kid realizes there are activities that he can, from his own initiative and abundant energy, get himself into that teaches him things about the world and about life to satisfy this intense curiosity he has. Yes?
What was your reaction to it?
Well, I thought it was cute myself. I thought it was funny. I started laughing about it, but Gail was just furious. Just, it seemed to me, you know, this is a cute kid's prank, and I was, you know, I went to class, and, you know, I teach school, after this happened, I told it to my class, and I kind of chuckled, but Gail was just furious. You know, she thought, my gosh, my kids are ruined now.